Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Nice to be back with all of you. I thought we could do something differently, but what I was thinking to do is just continue while I'm with you reading consecutively from Srimad Bhagavatam. I've been going through the first few chapters of Canto 3. Verse by verse, and although each place where the something is picked up without knowing all the detail that comes before it, it still somehow comes out very nice. When, just share this little experience. During the era of ISKCON, when these books were first being published, as new volume would come out, third canto, part one, third canto, part two, so forth. We would have them, a large quantity of these books would go to each temple. And we would be very enthusiastic to open the first box and look at the pictures. And try to get a gist of what the stories are and spend our time reading the books and spend our time distributing the books. And you might imagine the reaction of the public when they would get a copy and hold it, look at Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, part two. They would go, well, what happened to part one and what happened to the other cantos? And when we asked Srila Prabhupada, how do we respond to that question that people give? He said, you can say, like licking on an ice cream cone, you can lick from any side and it's very sweet. So that's what we said. Like they didn't even ask the question, we just gave that answer and just went right on, like describing the subject matter. And by describing the subject matter, that is also an art, the Prabhupada said, of distributing books. Just describe what the book is about. And it's so attractive, people want to purchase the book. Of course, there are ways to describe things in an attractive manner, knowing the individual. So you ask some question about the individual, and depending upon the individual, then you describe something that's in the book that would be attractive for that individual. Anyway, same here. Third canto, chapter 5, text 7. Well, what happened to all the other stuff? Because it's the Bhagavatam is in, like Bhagavad Gita, like much of the Vedic literature, is in the form of questions and answers. It's a dialogue. And if you come in right in the middle of a dialogue, two people are having a conversation, and you come right in the middle of that conversation, and they're speaking something you don't understand it right away because there's a context. There's something before it. It's something being said now, and then it leads to the next something. So I can give a little. I'd like to give a little bit of some background, but it leads before this third canto, chapter 5, text 7. But still, the essence of the Bhagavatam, because the nature of it is absolute, it doesn't take away from the importance of reading Srimad Bhagavatam chronologically and systematically. And when you do so, so many things of great value come out just by doing so. It's just designed in such a way that it just comes out. But this turns out to be a very easy to work with section in that way, because it's Vidura meeting with Maitreya, and in this chapter 5 there are a number of questions. The whole chapter is a series of questions, and this chapter, the questions in this chapter are so profound and deep and broad that the answer to chapter 5 constitutes a whole bunch of other cantos, because there's a lot of depth to them. So to go into what those questions are, although we don't already yet have the answers, the essence is that one's thought goes to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, which is the purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam. The purpose of our coming together in this association of one another as devotees is so that our attention goes to the Supreme Personality of God. The goal of life is so that that can happen. So hearing narrations about the Supreme Personality of Godhead is a natural way of life. And the Srimad Bhagavatam accomplishes that. And the questions of Vidura to Maitreya accomplish that. Prabhupada described when he was a small boy, even that recently, there was any time there was a holiday or a special day, the gathering would always, invariably, be centered on something from Ramayana or Mahabharata or Srimad Bhagavatam. Large assemblies of persons would come together in the evening, just as we're doing. Come together in the evening and hear something. And it was just part of the culture of how people grew up. And therefore, although they may have very busy lives because that was just part of the culture, the appreciation for Ramchandra's heroism and valor and great chivalry and his great sense of virtue was ingrained in people's lives. And all of the intrigues of Mahabharata and the struggle of virtue and vice, all of the great lessons of life, they're just part of the culture. And now in the absence of that, it's the culture of no culture, at least in the West. And the world is becoming like that. August 15th just passed, in India Independence Day. for years we've been participating in the India Independence Day Parade in New York. And something that I've noticed over the years is they know, the organizers know how to get the best attendance. And that is, they invite very well-known, I don't know who they are, well-known Bollywood stars. And when they have the Bollywood stars, oh, do people come out to the Independence Day Parade. And there's a phenomena that happens at the end when whatever the float is that they're on, they get off the float and they go to the stage, and there's this big rush of people that go to the stage. I've understood that means the Bollywood star is going to the stage. And they do whatever they do on the stage. I'm not paying attention to that because we're doing our thing at the booth. And as soon as they go off the stage, the party's over. The crowd disperses and the whole thing is over. Time has changed. The mode of passion, the worshipping of persons instead of worshipping of the Supreme Person has become the way of life. This Bhagavatam is to take us away from that culture of personalities to the transcendental realm. And these verses that I'm going to be reading, they're right on that target. So first a little background. Third canto, begins with a scene where something that was told back in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, chapter 13 of the first canto of the Bhagavatam, describes Vidura leaving home, and he goes on pilgrimage. He meets Maitreya, and in the course of the dialogues with Maitreya, he becomes a Mahabhagavata Vaishnava, and then he decides after those dialogues with Maitreya to go back and to deliver his brother, his blind elder brother, Dhritarashtra. So the deliverance of Dhritarashtra is the main subject of that 13th chapter. So much later, the rest of first canto is finished, the rest of second canto is narrated, and the stages of God realization are described, and so many things are described in the second canto. But the sages of Naimisharanya, they didn't fall asleep. They were very much appreciating something they heard way back in the first canto, and they then said to Sutta Goswami, that subject matter that you mentioned some time back, this dialogue between Vidura and Maitreya, Vidura is such already a saintly person, and by hearing from Maitreya, he became a perfected soul. Maitreya is such an elevated personality, he heard directly when Krishna was speaking Uddhava Gita. Those talks between those two must have been really wonderful. Can you describe what those conversations were? And prior to that, Vidura traveled to all the holy places throughout all the land. Could you describe some of those experiences of Vidura? And so Sutta Goswami obliges his audience and begins to describe the pilgrimage of Vidura. It goes back even to the mood of Vidura, when he heard Duryodhan insult him so viciously, he wasn't moved by remorse or anger or retaliation or... Rather, he realized that this situation is something that is beyond my capacity to do anything about. I don't know if you've been in situations where the complexity is such that, or the depth of an issue is such that, what can you do? I've been there many times. What can you do? And his thought went to, if I was more purified, I could perhaps have the influence to make this situation better. But I don't have that capacity. So he without ill feeling towards Duryodhana, he left the situation. He was trying to serve his brother. And so it's not like, okay, when you can't sort things out, just leave the situation. But his commitment was to become purified. And he was taking it as an opportunity. Krishna is giving me an opportunity to become purified. And specifically it describes, he could have just gone to Krishna at that time. Because you want purification, you go to the Supreme Pure to get purification. But he thought, no, I've had this terrible association with Duryodhan and company for so long. I've known of their intrigue for so long and I've done nothing about it because I was essentially powerless to do anything about it other than try to influence others. But I've become contaminated by their association. So I need to go to the holy places to purify myself, to qualify to be in Krishna's association. And he was also thinking, this is really good fortune. Because I'm going to have to make a decision about fighting or not fighting. Because this war isn't inevitable. It's very clear. Duryodhana is determined to have war. Because he's already experienced Krishna coming to plea for peace, a settlement, and Duryodhana rejected it. This person is incorrigible. There will be war. And because I've been, like Bhishma Dev, I've been maintained by the royal family. So when it comes to war, by religious duty, I'll be obliged to assist them because they're maintaining me. Bhishma Dev may have to make that difficult decision. I don't know. Krishna's giving me the opportunity to not have to make that decision. So he... When he was insulted, without saying a word, he took his bow and arrow, ceremoniously or symbolically placed them at the door before he left, and he left, indicating, I don't have to participate in this battle that's going to happen. And he left. Doesn't specifically say this, but he didn't even go say goodbye to his wife. He just left. And went to holy places throughout all the land. It describes those places that he went to by name and sages that he met there and so forth. And one of the places that he went to was Prabhas. And Prabhas is a sacred place near Dwarka. So it was a place that the Yadu dynasty and Krishna's family would often go to for purification, because you go to holy places for purification. So he had gone there, and he found what he had gone there, that the whole Yadu dynasty had left this world at Prabhas. And that shortly thereafter, Krishna left the world also. So he knew that. And he continued to visit some other places, and then eventually he came and he found Uddhava in the middle of a forest, who was a member of the Yadu dynasty, but he was surviving. And when he saw Uddhava in a forest, I mean, imagine you're going through a forest and there's Uddhava. He was very happy. And immediately, just by seeing Uddhava, he began speaking about Krishna. Because Uddhava was so intimately connected with Krishna. You see somebody intimately connected with somebody that is very dear to you, you ask them, how is that somebody that's very dear to you? It's just natural. And from speaking about Krishna and Balaram and, you know, Ugrasena and Rohini and all the residents of the Pandavas and the residents of Dwarka city, name, you know, person by person by person, although he knew that they were all gone. But it's very much like later, when Vidura was spoken to when he returned back to Hastinapur, and he was received by the Pandavas, and the Pandavas asked so many questions about, same, they say, oh, Uncle Vidura, you were on pilgrimage, you must have gone to Dwarka. How are Krishna and Balaram? How are the members of the Yadu dynasty? He just didn't answer the question. Because he didn't want to say it. Although he knew that they knew. He didn't want to say it. Oh, they're gone. So he knew that they've gone. And he knew that Vidura knew that they had gone. Still, he's asking about their welfare. Because he wanted to hear about them. And the mood of Uddhava was devastated. So he's giving Uddhava the opportunity to speak about Krishna. Because by speaking about Krishna, Uddhava became greatly enlivened. As we also become greatly enlivened just by speaking about Krishna. It's like that. We can not be in a good mood and take part in kirtan and all of a sudden we're happy again. Or troubled by something and you sit and read Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita and all of that goes away and your consciousness becomes refreshed by transcendental vibration. So he was asking about Krishna. And 2.5 chapters follow just by Uddhava's response to thinking about Krishna. But before he was even able to respond, Uddhava went into a trance of absorbed meditation upon Krishna. His eyes were closed. His whole body was trembling. Tears were streaming from his eyes. He was in a state of bhava, ecstasy. And the first portion of his speech, it's very emotional, transcendentally amplified emotion in a mood of feelings of separation from Krishna. Because Krishna just left. Not only just left you know, the world. He was just there with Uddhava in the forest, and Krishna left. He describes the whole thing. And in the course of describing Krishna's departure, he says something that's very confusing or puzzling. He speaks not so much about his pain of separation, but he speaks of the pain of Krishna's pastimes. And he speaks of them repeatedly in terms of how ordinary people don't understand them. It pains him that ordinary people don't understand him. And because they don't understand him, when they see his pastimes, they think of his pastimes as ordinary, when they're not at all ordinary. And that pains him. It pains him too much. And he gives, you know, there are four or five different words in Sanskrit that indicate his pain. And there's some of the different types of, or grades of, or qualities of that pain. The great pain. And specifically, it pains him his pastime of separation, or of his pastime of disappearance. So there's the pain of his separation, but he's amplifying or emphasizing more the pain that ordinary people just don't understand. He says, he who is, it's all these enigmatic, conflicting qualities of Krishna. He who is unborn becomes born. He who is the source of every living being takes birth as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki. He who is feared by fear personified becomes afraid of Kamsa. So much so that he asks Vasudev to carry him to the other side of the river Jamuna for safety, to be away from Kamsa. And then after he comes back to Mathura and he's standing before Vasudev and Devaki, who he was the source of, he speaks of them with deep respect as his mother and father and says, I'm sorry, I was unable to perform my duties to you because I was afraid of Kamsa. He who is the cause of all causes causes his own appearance and causes his own disappearance. And this brings me great pain because people don't understand. He goes through his childhood pastimes. He launches into a whole chapter of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan in chronological order. It's like little cameo meditations on Krishna's Leela, but it's not, it's his ecstasy in one sense. And then Krishna leaves Vrindavan. And that's also very painful. And Krishna enters Mathura, and Krishna breaks the bow and kills Kulvayapita and kills Kamsa and stands before his mother and father. Again, he apologizes very sincerely for being unable to serve them properly. Sends his father back. Soon I will come back to Vrindavan. Please go. He goes through all of his pastimes, then concludes his marriage of so many, killing so many demons, and marriages of so many wives, and comes to the narration where his son, Samba, standing before the Brahmanas, Krishna's son has offended the Brahmanas by making a joke of their so-called prowess by saying, by dressing in a sari and shyly covering his head so his friends would say, could you please tell us, this pregnant woman would like to know what kind of child will be born to her. And the brahmanas, they're at a festival in some place, and the brahmanas know very well these are just young boys pulling their leg, making fun of them. And so they made a curse. There's details to it. This lump of iron that is in this woman, beneath the woman's sari, that lump of iron will be the destruction of the entire Yadu dynasty for your having offended the brahmanas. Because as representatives, the purport is, as representatives of a great dynasty, one should be respectful to the brahmanas. But by showing disrespect to the brahmanas, it's calamity. We shouldn't make such a calamity happen. We shouldn't be disrespectful to those who are very dear to Krishna, the cows and the brahmanas in particular. It brings destruction. So the detail is then narrated that that lump of iron was then brought before Ugrasena, giving the report, the brahmanas have given this curse, this lump of iron will be the destruction of our entire dynasty. So Ugrasena consulted his ministers, and the brahmanas who weren't offended, and they gave him the following advice: take that lump of iron and grind it into powder and dismiss the powder into the ocean, disperse it. As they were grinding, so much powder was generated, but there was another piece that wouldn't grind, like a core piece that wouldn't grind. So they took that core piece and the powder and threw it into the river, into the ocean. So you know the powder portion went on the shore, washed up on the shore, and it became taken into the reeds that were growing at the edge of the ocean. And it was those reeds that were like iron that the Yadu dynasty used to destroy one another. But the other piece that was thrown into the ocean, the part that wouldn't grind into powder, was swallowed by a fish. And later that fish was captured in a net by a fisherman. And when the fish that was in the net was sold in the marketplace, a hunter bought the fish. And when the hunter opened the fish, he found this piece of iron inside the fish. And he thought, oh, this will make a very good arrowhead. So he took the iron and made an arrowhead, and it was that arrowhead that shot the heel of Krishna. Uddhava's comment is, he who is unborn is born. And he who is eternal and never dies, dies. By an arrangement of his own internal potency, with such intricacy and involvement, it brings me great pain. The pain of separation is one thing. The pain that ordinary people don't understand and therefore speak of Krishna as ordinary and make offense against Krishna as if he's ordinary, it brings great pain to a personality like Uddhava. As they're speaking, they met around sunset. Uddhava and Vidura. And by the time he finishes speaking all about Krishna, it's the next morning. And he tells Vidura, I have to go now. Krishna just left. because he explains that I was told by Krishna to go in Dwarka. I was told by Krishna to go. Soon I'm going to leave. So I want you to be safe after I've gone. You take association of the devotees of Nara Narayan. In Badrinath, go there at once. So I went, but I couldn't bear the separation from Krishna, so I came back. But Krishna had gone, so I was searching for Krishna. He found Krishna. The whole Uddhava Gita was narrated. There's details discussing when, as he was speaking, Maitreya also happened to find, coincidentally, that same place in the forest where Krishna was speaking. He just happened to come by, just diddy-bopping through the forest, and there was Krishna and Uddhava. So Maitreya heard the whole Uddhava Gita firsthand. So Uddhava is saying, Krishna ordered me. He gave me some service to do. He gave me service to do so it would sustain my life. Otherwise, I have no reason to even sustain my life in the absence of Krishna, but he's given me some service. He wanted to go to Badrinath because the Lord appears in the world to satisfy the hearts of his devotees. And so many places, and he lists the so many places where Krishna went to satisfy the hearts of his devotees. But that was one place he was unable to personally go. He left that for me to go in his place. He's given me that service, so I must go. And with great grief in his heart, he hadn't slept all night long, pained from feelings of separation, pained from understanding that worldly people aren't going to understand Krishna. He went to give Krishna's association through the words of Krishna. One can give Krishna's association. So he went to Badrinath. He said, so before I go, not far away is Maitreya. He is elder to me in any case, elder by years at least. And it would be more appropriate that you hear about Krishna, hear Krishna Katha from him. So go find Maitreya. And he follows, he feels great pain in separation from Uddhava. Uddhava mentioned that just before Krishna left, he spoke about you. So Vidura is feeling thrilled that just before Krishna's leaving, he spoke about him, but great pain at the same time, feelings of separation from Krishna. Transcendental life has these conflicting emotions. It's hard to manage conflicting emotions if you haven't noticed, but it's part of transcendental life because there are things that happen that are simultaneously very difficult to deal with. At the same time, some special fortune of Krishna is involved in some situation. It depends on how you look at it, and sometimes you're feeling both. Uddhava is feeling, Vidura is feeling both. Joy and great sorrow. So he goes some distance and he finds Maitreya. Some very beautiful paintings our artists have created where Vidura finds Maitreya in the forest. And he begins naturally. Now, Maitreya specifically, in contrast to Uddhava, Maitreya is more of a sage. And it's not to say that Uddhava wasn't well-educated. Uddhava was so well-educated, he was advising Krishna. Highly learned. But Maitreya particularly was a learned sage. But now he's not just a learned sage. He's now a pure devotee also from that hearing from Krishna in the presence of Uddhava and Krishna. And Vidura knows that. So Vidura, who is also very learned and very wise and very deep and very profound, he's very eager to inquire from Maitreya. And that's how the chapter begins. His enthusiasm, how fortunate I am to meet such a great personality as you. Please fulfill my desires by describing so many topics that I'd like to hear from you. And a note of appreciation is we may also know so many things in the course of our short time in Krishna consciousness. We know so many things. But in the presence of a qualified personality like Maitreya, Vidura, who's Yamaraj himself and has been part of the royal, his Leela, but part of the royal family and respected by everybody as wise Uncle Vidura. Before Maitreya, he's at his feet, eager to hear. This principle of eagerness to hear spiritual topics from qualified persons is what carries us to further and further stages of Krishna consciousness. And even as far as that goes, the subject in the company of one another, hearing and discussing Krishna Katha, it doesn't matter who's asking the question, who's giving the answer. Both are getting great spiritual benefit. One can achieve spiritual perfection from either position, being Maharaj Parikshit or Shukadeva Goswami, just hearing Krishna Katha. So as devotees, when we come together to assist one another in advancing in Krishna consciousness, doing the same thing that they're doing, inquiring. Kind of like what we do when we have our Bhakti Vriksha groups. We read Prabhupada's teachings and then look at the teachings and say, well, what's the subject matter here? What's the important message that Prabhupada is giving? So we're hearing and chanting by design, transcendental topics. And it works. It elevates our consciousness. And so many things come out that we didn't see, that others see. And some things that we can see that others may not have seen. And there's this appreciation of centered on Krishna, Krishna Katha. It's wonderful. It's magical. So that's what's happening here, only it's in a forest, not in the suburbs of Detroit. Here's the first of the verses we're going to look at. Vidura says to Maitreya, you may narrate also about the auspicious characteristics of the Lord in his different incarnations for the welfare of the twice-born, the cows, and the demigods. Our minds are never satisfied completely, although we continuously hear of his transcendental activities. In the purport, which I'm not going to read, Prabhupada goes through one by one the twice-born. What's the role of the twice-born in a cultured society? Doesn't just mean the brahmanas, twice born. Brahmanas are brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas. But those who are twice born are those that understand the value of spiritual life as opposed to simply the value of bodily satisfaction or gratification. They understand there's a value or a purpose beyond the animal propensities. And so they become twice born. And so Krishna appears for their benefit. He appears for the benefit of the cows. The cow is the most important animal for developing the human body to perfection. Describes the role of the cows within advanced civilization. And the demigods, in contrast to the worldly persons, not just they enjoy opulence that's very vastly superior to human society. They're in that position of demigods because of their dedication to the personality of Godhead. And they're serving him directly to maintain in a very responsible manner the affairs of the universe which the Lord has created. So the Lord appears for their upliftment, the twice born, the cows and the brahmanas. And then the discussion about the nature of Krishna Katha. It never brings the point of satiation, as opposed to mundane literature that also has so many different topics, but after reading those topics, they're discarded. Prabhupada speaks about one of his favorite things, the newspapers. And after reading the newspaper, even an hour old, it's thrown in the dustbin. It's reading literature for the crows. The crows come to the dustbin and they read the newspaper too.
Rubbish.
Rubbish literature. But the Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita and the topics about Krishna are never old or hackneyed, or they never become outdated. The same subject matter today being narrated brings life and joy to those who take part in it. So Vidura wants to hear that from Maitreya. The Supreme King of all kings has created different planets and places of habitation where living entities are situated in terms of the modes of nature of work and work. And he has created their different kings and rulers. O chief among the brahmanas, please also describe how Narayana, the creator of the universe and the self-sufficient Lord, has differently created the natures, activities, forms, features, and names of the different living creatures. Wow, that's an encyclopedia question for you. And Maitreya is going to answer that. And when Maitreya is answering that, or we're reading that portion of the Bhagavatam that has a description of the different parts of creation, commonly devotees kind of skim through that quickly because it's not, there's detail because the process of creation requires describing how it all comes together rather than just simply saying, like in biblical terms, God created everything in 7 days and said it was good. Okay. And then the Bhagavatam goes into the detail and the detail and the detail and the detail and the detail. And we read the detail and goes, oh boy, when's the good stuff coming? But it's an important subject matter. It takes up a significant portion of the third canto. It takes up a significant portion of the second canto. It takes up a significant portion of the fifth canto. it's an important subject matter. Again, this is Vidura. He could have asked anything of Maitreya, and he's asking about this process of creation. Here's a very nice way the Prabhupada has elaborated on in the purport. Lord Krishna is the chief king of all kings and has created different planets for all kinds of living entities. Even on this planet, there are different places for habitation by different types of men. There are places like deserts, Icelands, and valleys in mountainous countries. And in each of them, there are different kinds of men, born of different modes of nature according to their past deeds. There are people in the Arabian deserts and in the valleys of the Himalayan mountains. And the inhabitants of these two places differ from one another, just as the inhabitants of Icelands also differ from them. Similarly, there are also various kinds of living beings, various planets. The planets below the earth, down to the Patala planet, are full of various kinds of living beings. No planet is vacant, as wrongly imagined by the modern so-called scientist. In Bhagavad Gita, we find it said by the Lord that the living entities are sarvagata, or present in every sphere of life. So there is no doubt that on other planets there are also inhabitants like us, sometimes with greater intelligence and greater opulence. The living conditions for those of greater intelligence are far more luxurious than on this earth. There are also planets where no sunlight reaches, and there are living entities who must live there due to their past deeds. All such plans for living conditions are made by the Supreme Lord, and Vidura requested Maitreya to describe this for the sake of further enlightenment. So he's asking about Krishna and his appearances and their various features. He's asking to have Maitreya describe the process of creation and the various types of residences for the various grades of living entities. Next, he's going to address, about the activities, the duties of mankind. It's shadowing a little bit the Purusha Sukta prayers that are discussed in the second canto of the Bhagavatam, a whole chapter on how the Supreme Personality Godhead is the cause of all causes and how he brings about creation. So in describing the creation, one of the things that's found in the Purusha Sukta prayers, and here also, is the duties of those beings that are created in these different residential places. What's their duty? So here's how Vidura expresses that. O my Lord, I have repeatedly heard about these higher and lower statuses of human society from the mouth of Vyasa Deva. And I am quite satiated with all these lesser subject matters and their happiness. They have not satisfied me with the nectar of topics about Krishna. Now, he said previously, please tell me about the pastimes of the Lord, for I am never satiated. Now he's saying the opposite. I heard all things about duties, and so much I'm satiated. So, what does that mean? Does that mean that we don't have to concern ourselves, because it's just mundane, to concern yourself with what's virtue, what is right and wrong, what is to be done and not to be done? We don't have to worry ourselves about that. Just chant and hear Krishna Katha. Don't worry about your duties of life and how to do them properly. That's not what it means. Rather, the consistent message of the Bhagavatam is that all of that, minus in the absence of Krishna, one may become perfected in all brahminical duties, but if that person is not a devotee of the Lord, then he can't deliver himself, or to speak of his family members, but or anyone else. So the duties of life must be joined with Krishna Katha as the message. And he knows that he can receive that from Maitreya, and so that's what he wants to hear. A little bit, I'll read the purport. Vidura explained to Maitreya his position of being fully satiated with the knowledge of mundane social and political topics and having no more interest in them. He was anxious to hear transcendental topics regarding Lord Sri Krishna because there were insufficient topics directly concerning Krishna in the Puranas, Mahabharata, etc. He was not satisfied and wanted to know more about Krishna. Krishna Katha, or topics related to Krishna, are transcendental, and there is no satiation in hearing such topics. Bhagavad Gita is important on account of its being Krishna Katha, or speeches delivered by Lord Krishna. But even in the speech given by Lord Krishna, he's certainly speaking about duty. Our whole one of the consistent lamentations I have about life in America, or people of having no spiritual culture, is that their lives become so quickly degraded. That at least where there's a sense of culture, there's a sense of respect for life, respect for other living beings. And minus that, it's lawlessness. I was having lunch with some devotees yesterday, and we're just, you know, spinning out about the examples of rampant lawlessness, without going through that discussion again. From the top leaders of society, and just, you know, every day walking in the street, just everybody in the street. The modes of nature are there, so there are persons that are more of the quality of goodness, and their mode of passion is there, and persons more in the quality of passion, and so forth, mode of ignorance, and violence and harsh crime and so forth springs out of this mode of ignorance. But the people in the ruling position, they're also doing the same thing all over the world. Not just the West, all over the world. What to do? It's very much a Srimad Bhagavatam question, that the sages huddle together at the beginning of the age of Kali and asking themselves what to do. They know that it's going to become very bad. What to do? Or Vyasadeva, looking ahead and seeing the circumstance of Kali Yuga. He's Trikalagya, so he could see a very cultured person seeing very clearly where is this age going? What to do? As thoughtful citizens of this planet, what to do? And besides, get the heck out of here. These people are crazy. Do something that has some substance. It's not just do something that has no substance. So the Bhagavatam gives that purpose. Certainly part of purpose is to understand what is duty. What are we obliged to do? What are we bound to do in different circumstances of life? And certainly a difference between a cultured and an uncultured person is a cultured person knows what to do in different circumstances. At least dutifully, I'm bound by duty. But that doesn't endure and doesn't ultimately elevate without Krishna katha, without Krishna consciousness. So we have this like wonderful challenge to act in an appropriate manner in a society of people that are uncivilized, at the same time be Krishna conscious, not just like get the heck out of here and be Krishna conscious. We're to do our prescribed duty and always think of Krishna. And by so doing, bring real benefit to our lives and those who our lives come in contact with. There are little remnants and vestiges and so forth of Vedic culture here and there, even within our modern society, but it doesn't come together. I was with a disciple of Bhakti Truswami yesterday. I think it was yesterday, day before yesterday. And he said something that, he repeated something that Bhakti Truswami had shared with him. When he was young, when Bhakti Truswami was a young devotee, young man, he, as Prabhupada recognized that Bhakti Truswami was a very special personality, so very quickly Prabhupada gave him first initiation, second initiation, and sannyas. Like, boom, boom, boom. Prabhupada didn't ordinarily do something like that, but he certainly recognized that with Srila Prabhupada, or with Bhakti Truswami. And so he shared, as a sannyas disciple of Srila Prabhupada, there were opportunities that came along. He gave a specific one. I don't need to mention what that specific one was, but he was offered the position of being an acharya in some mutt. And Bhakti Truswami rejected it, saying simply, it's not being an acharya of some mutt that's going to make a difference in the world, but Srila Prabhupada and his teachings, this Hare Krishna movement, has the potential, the potency to change the world. I've heard him say that so many times. He believes it. It's not like a recent, it's not cosmetic or some, you know, to create an effect. He deeply believes it, and it's true, that the message of the Bhagavatam is revolutionary. And that which is revolutionary in the hands of a personality who understands the depth of it and is offering it to the world, we can simply assist that personality and the world can change. At least that piece of the world that we come in contact with can change. And collectively we come in contact with a significant part of the world. One of the advantages of sannyas, there's many, but I get an opportunity to travel and experience different things, different devotees in different situations. And there is certainly vast diversity of culture and language and all those things. But there's a consistency, uniformity in the... When you meet a devotee, a Hare Krishna devotee, it's very clear. They don't even have to say it. You can see it. There's a radiance, a luster, a mannerisms even, regardless of culture. I was just in Hong Kong for the first time, taking part in a meeting with the mainland China devotees on behalf of the executive committee. And, you know, culture is so different, language is so different, but the spirit of the devotees is wonderful. And, you know, sitting and listening to the things that they were describing, they go through the same things we go through. You know, even the history of their movement in China has, you know, the ups and the downs, and the things that cause the ups and things that cause the downs, and where their challenges are, and things that they need to do to meet those challenges. And it's so similar. But, you know, the solution is the same solution. In one sense, I mean, the details, how to deal with the government and so on, is a whole other thing, issue. But, you know, on a personal level, to meet the challenges of modern life and to sustain Krishna consciousness is the same basic things. What I'm trying to say here is we have a even in these little questions that are being asked by Vidura, we have a blueprint of how to go beyond to go to cultured life, but go to beyond mundane cultured life. The world that we're in is not at all cultured. To become cultured and transcendentally situated in Vedic or Krishna conscious culture of life is our challenge. And the challenge is, you know, very interesting in Detroit. Motown and, you know, the whole thing. And then, you know, China is very different. And, you know, each place is different. But the blueprint is here. Universal. And we take these essence things and apply them as it's appropriate to apply them. It's transforming. It's all there within Srimad Bhagavatam. A devotee shared this with me that very similar to Prabhupada making a statement like this about chanting of the holy name. But one time, Prabhupada was receiving new volumes of books that had just been printed. And those devotees who had that experience, I never had that experience of being in Prabhupada's room when he was receiving new books, but it was like a very sacred moment. Everything would stop. Prabhupada would give undivided attention to the books, and he would, you know, very carefully, because he knew about publication, he would examine the binding and he looked at the color printing, and, you know, he was examining the quality of the publication and critiquing it. But he was also appreciating what his effort was now, had come to a position where it could deliver this knowledge to others. And he would start reading from it sometimes. So one time he was reading some passages, and in the presence of the devotees. And then he closed the book like this, put his thumb in the page, and became very grave and said, one day there may be no temples. One day there may be no devotees, but there will always be my books. It was like, it was his gift to the world. He's giving the Vaishnav Sangha and giving temples where he can go and gather and worship and serve together. But supposing those things were taken away, this would endure. This was his vision of what the gift of Srimad Bhagavatam that he was offering the world. Or say it the other way around. From the Srimad Bhagavatam will come temples and will come devotees. Just from the book. So what a great treasure, how much value can come into our lives from the teaching and the direction from Srimad Bhagavatam itself and Prabhupada's transcendental commentary to guide our lives out of this culture of no culture to a life of transcendental culture. It's ours for the taking, if we can receive it. Okay, so I'll end. See if there's any comments or questions.
Thank you very much, Maharaj, for the class. One thing, in the start of the class, you mentioned about Krishna being afraid of Kamsa. So far I have heard of Krishna being afraid of Yashoda Mata and all this in relationship with devotees. But Kamsa is certainly not a devotee. So I'm confused about that.
I'm not confused about it. It's Leela. When he went into the wrestling arena, it's described he with Krishna and Balaram, they're walking with the tusks of Kuvalyapita, this huge elephant that they just, smashed and broke off his tusk and carrying the bloody end of the tusk over their shoulder. Chivalry, they're not afraid. He's the personality of Godhead. What's he afraid of? And when he entered into the arena and saw Kamsa seated on the high seat, it's described in the Bhagavatam that his eyes kept going to Kamsa, using the metaphor like a lusty boy seeing a beautiful young girl. He couldn't take his eyes off of Kamsa, wanting to kill Kamsa. What's the fear? But before his mother and father, he was taking that position. Because everyone's afraid of Kamsa. And they're just so, they're the little son. I'm sorry, I was afraid of. I wasn't able to do my duty. Please forgive me. Anything else? Yeah?
A question about this word dvija. So the initiation in which one carries the sacred thread and becomes second initiated, after that one can either become a brahmana, kshatriya or vaishya depending upon what he is by his tendencies. Is that right?
In the varnashram system, yes.
Okay. But in ISKCON we generally say brahmin initiated. We don't say kshatriya or vaishya initiated.
Well, I don't know what people say that aren't devotees about someone is Brahmin initiated or Kshatriya initiated or Vaishya initiated. I've never heard that. They're twice born.
So, but
a Vaishya is twice born. A Kshatriya is twice born. They don't say Kshatriya initiated or Vaishya initiated. Twice born. Meaning they've undergone Upanayana. They have sacred thread. They're chanting Brahma Gayatri.
I heard some devotee telling me that he's going to get Brahmin initiated, and he inquired what are the duties of a Brahmana. So I was thinking, it one may be Kshatriya, so one or Vaishya, so one doesn't need to have those qualities of a Brahmana and still get second initiated.
Okay, this is the, you know, the Daivi Varnashram conversation. While we, each of us, have our nature, we're becoming Vaishnavas, devotees of the Lord. And one who is a Vaishnava or a devotee of the Lord, in the association of the Lord through the medium of service, there are qualities that develop, qualities of a Vaishnava. Many of those qualities of a Vaishnava are closely resemble the qualities of a Brahmana, because this is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's teaching. A Brahmana is one who knows Brahman. And how can one have proper understanding of Brahman if one is not a Vaishnav? So we're in the process of becoming trained to become devotees. From, although we have our propensities, we have prior to training, we have not proper culture. So the qualities of a Brahmana that we're being trained in doesn't discount, I may have the nature of an administrator, I may have the nature of a business person, but we're being trained in the qualities of a devotee in such a way, whatever it is that we do it for Krishna. Oh, so it's Daivi Varnashram. And some persons may not need Brahminical initiation. But a Kshatriya and a Vaishya will need to become twice born. And our just specifically mention it this way. While in Hong Kong, I was looking through their standards for second initiation, and common to outside of China is the same message that they were saying. There's not really, if one is not prepared to seriously take up deity worship, there's not really a necessity to have second initiation. Now, one can worship a deity if one is a Marjambarish head, was a worshipper of Krishna deity. Or a business person can be a worshipper of Krishna. If my propensity is I'm a businessman, or I'm an agriculturalist, or I protect cows. Nanda Maharaj had deity, but his propensity is cow protection, Vaishya. But he's also the king of the cowherds. So he's Kshatriya. But he's devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he's worshipping a deity. So it's this blend. It's not, you know, disregard. Transcendental life is not disregard for propensity. Nor is the Varnashram Asuric Varnashram, where it doesn't matter about worshipping the deity form of the Lord. You just have duties and you perform your duties and you don't regard the personality of Godhead. This is a blend. It's we have duties and we're worshipping the personality of Godhead. So second initiation for a devotee is to help further elevate us by Vedic processes, particularly study of the scripture and worshipping the deity form of the Lord. One can do that without initiation. One can do that with first initiation. It's to help qualify us by second initiation. Particularly installed deities in the temple. One can't worship without or cook. The standard for cooking in the temple kitchen should be brahmanas only, cooking for the deity. Anyone can cook. Children can cook. But it should be qualified persons who are purified, refined through knowledge and training and higher quality. So developing brahminical quality to do that service, regardless of what my psychophysical nature might be. So it's the Vaishnava principle is elevating all classes to this more refined position. Very complicated topic, or involved topic, Varnashram. Anyone else? Yeah.
Maharaj, you mentioned that like while doing our duties, we have to be Krishna conscious. And I'm thinking of a particular situation where I'll have to do on Monday. There's a bunch of students who will be coming, freshmen, and then we have to sit with them and make them comfortable. So like what I understand is, of course, it's difficult to do serious talk and just some light conversation. So can you please guide how we can be Krishna conscious in that those type of situations?
The essence is as a grihastha you have an occupation, and that occupation requires certain things of you, and you do those certain things mindful that this should be done in such a way it's pleasing to Krishna, which includes, you know, I won't do certain things because it's not pleasing to Krishna, but I'll do these things because in the consciousness that it's service to Krishna. It's not secular. Or I do that over there, although it has nothing to do with Krishna, because I have to earn some money, and then I do these things over here, that's what I do for Krishna. So the principle is, you do that for Krishna. So if you're carrying the consciousness of Krishna with you into that situation, you know, it's easy to theoretically think about it. It's a whole other thing to actually carry the consciousness of Krishna into that activity. But if you do, then the light conversation and so on. Bhaktivinoda Thakur discusses this in Bhaktiloka, which is a description of the six things that destroy bhakti and the six things that enhance bhakti. So in the thing that destroys bhakti, it's janasanga, associating with worldly people. So specifically, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, for those who are grihasthas, to engage in social niceties, formalities, in those situations that are part of one's occupation, that's not janasanga. You're not, you know, if I were to do that, it might be. But as a grihastha, that's part of what's called upon you to do. And you do that, you're polite and cordial. It's not the essence of your life, just being polite and cordial to mundane people doing some mundane things. But if you're trying to do that in a way that Krishna would be pleased with your how you're executing this particular duty of your life, maybe in the course of the execution of your role like that, someone may inquire something spiritual, who knows. But at least, you know, you're bringing, and that will give you a direct opportunity. Of course, you have to be careful from the context of being a professor representing the university that you're not hammering people. But you wouldn't do that anyways. But you carry Krishna consciousness as your part of your character. So persons over a period of time will come to know you, will come to know, you know, he has a particular religious, you know, a deep religious affiliation. And they'll often value or evaluate based upon your qualities. And your qualities are going to have some strong bearing. Governing them is, you know, are you doing what you do for Krishna? It's not just you're polite, you say please and thank you, but there's a quality, a depth of character that a devotee has, one who's deeply devoted. It has a richness, and people are attracted to that. You'll be able to attract people to Krishna. You'll be able to be a servant of Krishna in that circumstance over a period of time by factually being Krishna conscious. And even if persons don't come and start asking you questions about your religious convictions, if they simply have some appreciation for you as a person, there's spiritual benefit for them. Oh, here's a person of really fine character, really fine quality. You're not trying to impress them, kind of mentality, but trying to please Krishna. Persons will be spiritually benefited, however indirectly. Agyata Sukriti. By appreciating Krishna's devotee, they're getting spiritual merit. That's part of your service as a grihastha in the world. And by that carrying thought of Krishna, doing things for Krishna, consciousness, some direct opportunities will present themselves in the course of time too. People will ask, hey, something. So it's more long-term than short-term, I guess, is it? My message here. It's protecting you and impacting slowly and gently on others. Anything else? Yes?
Years ago, actually decades ago, it seemed to be more natural and easier for me to talk to people about Krishna, because I really had this idea that when I met Srila Prabhupada that everyone was going to become interested just like I did. And it seems like over the years I've got some kind of mental block that I kind of feel like most people won't be interested or something like that. I don't know how to explain it, but it's not as natural for me and spontaneous to try to present Krishna consciousness like it used to be. And how can I regain that spirit?
Well, I can take it from either of the two sides. One is youthful idealism doesn't match reality, and now you're being more real. That's another way of saying you're not like lacking enthusiasm necessarily, but just being more real. But on the other side, one of the things that inspired us to think that way was the way that we engaged ourselves. We engaged ourselves, for example, in Harinam and book distribution till the cows came home. I mean, day in and day out, and day in and day out, and day in and day out, and day in and day out. And we were meeting all kinds of people that, whatever their response was, you know, it was day in and day out. And we learned by that activity, we learned the art of how to present Krishna consciousness in such a way it would be attractive to all types of people. And we just became empowered to do that. I mean, in retrospect, that's what was happening. So, so on the other side is just do more of it. Not necessarily day in, day out, but do more of it. Just, you know, go out of your way on a regular basis of reaching out to people that whether it looks like they may be interested or doesn't look like they may be interested. And present and be ready for some surprises. Same surprises that we got before was some people would just say, you know, get out of here. Well, we didn't bother with that. We just went to the next person. Or some people would say all types of things. I would say, just from my own recent experience, the interest in Krishna consciousness has become significantly greater amongst young people in America today. Not only just young people, just the mood of spiritual seeking. Now, people don't even know what barometers to use for spiritual seeking. But there's a lot of spiritual seeking. So you'll get a lot of, you know, reinforcement and encouragement to continue to, but set aside some time in your week where some time is dedicated to reaching out to people who you don't know and see what happens. Book distribution is a great way to do that. Or Harinam. And there's response. Or some form or fashion. one devotee just wrote to me saying that he really likes whatever discretionary time he has. He lives in Alachua, so he's dedicating it to Krishna.com support team because they have people writing in, calling in, you know, and finding people that have an interest in Krishna. They're all over the place. That just on the travel here, because I look a little different than most people on the airplanes. When I travel with Southwest, it's, you know, you pick your own seat. There's not an assigned seat, so I sit in an aisle seat, and commonly I'm one of the last seats to have somebody sitting next to me because I'm a little different. And I don't mind that. I have an empty seat next to me. That's nice. But it's becoming more the case of people, they see a devotee and then they want to, like, you know, check you out. Come and, you know. So that happened. Somebody came and sat right, you know, may I? And, you know, right away conversation and, you know, interested in spiritual life. And wow. It's common. Becoming, again, more common. But the soul is always hankering for a connection with Krishna. And it may be, you know, covered. But the soul is hankering. Just find a way. On the platform of the soul, find a way to resonate with that soul. That's refreshing. Okay. Thank you very much. In the Prabhupada ki jai.